Fanboy Smackdown, episode number 35. This is the anniversary show. Hey, this is Tony.
And this is Tony.
And welcome to the anniversary episode of Fanboy Smackdown Podcast.
Happy 1 year, man.
Happy 1 year, dude.
I have a lot to say, and I can't think of any of it right now. So what do you got to say?
Oh, man. Well, it's been a year, and we are recording this on the day that... The first episode hit the feed, 1st of May, which some of you may be well aware. There's a special song that goes along with today, but we won't get into that right now because we're not going to go explicit on this particular episode.
Right.
it's our anniversary show, and we're going to deviate just slightly from our new format, because what we're going to do in this episode is talk about a couple of our favorite movies.
And they're good movies, too. I mean, we don't want to lie to you. They're pretty darn good.
No. And by the fact that they are our favorite movies, we're probably not going to be all that negative on them.
Right.
We're probably going to be gushing fanboys through most of this.
Absolutely.
This particular episode.
And, you know, I thought maybe we would take a couple of minutes to discuss how your life has changed since Fanboy Smackdown after a year. And how my life has changed.
All right.
What
well,
do you say?
That sounds good to me. Let's see, as far as my life, I've met a lot of really cool people. You know, both in person and on the internet. That are attached to the podcasting community, made some friends, have a lot of people that listen to us and follow what we say, which is, you know, it's both kind of cool and it feeds the ego, but it's also a little bit frightening that people are taking our advice on if they're going to go see a movie or not. I think it's very cool though.
Wow.
I mean, otherwise, I mean...
Do you really think people take our advice that much?
I think they listen to us, and they may... I mean, I think our opinions are fairly well-formed.
Yeah, we don't sound dumb. I mean, who's talking to who? But, I think we do a pretty good job of forming our opinions and...
I think we do a pretty good job of forming our opinions.
Stroking
and I think,
our own,
you know,
egos. And...
Yeah, exactly. and I think, you know, we'll occasionally throw out a surprise to someone that, you know, either a movie that we haven't seen or an opinion about a movie. But I think we're fairly consistent in what we like and what we don't like. And, I mean, there are things that I like that you don't and vice versa. And I think that, you know, our consistency is people are able to tell, you know, hey, you know, I don't agree with them on a certain type of movie, so, and they liked it, so I might not, you know. If we're reviewing a movie that someone hasn't seen before, for example, you know, if somebody doesn't really care for Serenity for some of the reasons we gave, and there was a new sci-fi movie. And we had very similar reasons for liking that movie as we had for listening to, or for liking Serenity. They might say that, you know, that movie might not be for me if that's what I'm to expect from it. So
right,
it's a long way of going about it, but
I mean, you're right though. I mean, that's basically that's what we do.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
we have our opinions. We put them out there, and you know, I look at this as, you know, as a way, you know, it's the opportunity for us to hang out, even if it's, you know, on the computer, on the phone, or you know, getting together and having a couple of drinks, which we haven't done in a while. We need to
get back to doing it the
old way.
Our lives have just become so exponentially busy.
It's amazing. It's busy, but But you know what? It's still cool to hang out and talk movies and you know, we're just the guys that also are recording what we're talking about and putting it out there for other people to listen to. And I mean, that's changing slightly. I think, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we've taken a good hard look at what we've done, and you know, we've made some changes to the format, and we've added Darren Josh to the team, and they're great with their reviews.
Oh yeah, they make the website a real website. I mean, it's constantly busy.
It gives us constant content. It's great,
and people comment on it. It's really awesome.
Yes, it is.
I'm really digging
it. Yes, it is. They're doing a great job, and we hope to keep them around for a long time. And you know, let them know what you're thinking. If you know, jump out there if you can and take a look at their reviews. They're not giving any spoilers in their reviews. So if you're interested in, excuse me, in some of the new movies that are coming out, check it out. And I know right now we've got from this past weekend, we've got the movie Next is out
right
there that Darren reviewed. We've got this to that and to the website. We've got a couple of more changes coming up that we aren't 100% ready to talk about yet, but they're only for the positive, and what it might mean in the future is that we will be able to do some true reviews of movies that you guys might not have had the chance to see.
Yeah, actually be semi-professional.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in which case, we probably won't do our big, you know, spoilerific
right
portion right after it. But what it could give us the opportunity to do is do, for example, if we had the opportunity to have Spider-Man already, maybe this episode where we review Spider-Man, so you have an idea of what we think about it before you get a chance to see it, before it's in the theater. And then what we do during the second part is, you know, dig in deep to Spider-Man 1 and 2 or some other movie.
Yeah, that would be cool. Yeah, a little review of what we've seen and then just a commentary on the new one.
On something similar in a similar vein.
To put it in the context of its for viewers, you know, what they're
exactly
going to get.
Exactly.
My life's changed a little bit. I mean,
yeah, you've had a couple changes.
Yeah, I mean, I was in a bar the other day, and I got into a little scuffle with a gentleman, and he broke his beer bottle on the table and said, "I'm going to smack you down." And I said, "Well, you know, if it's okay with you, I'd prefer you just send us mail, and we can discuss it later."
Exactly.
And then there was a time when somebody yelled at me, "Hey, nerd boy," and I said, "Well, it's fanboy, but thanks for listening to the SmackDown. I really appreciate
exactly
it."
Exactly.
And I also used our campaign funds to pay for a $400 haircut, but it only cost me $10, so I saved $390. So
that's awesome.
I was really happy about that too.
That's very good.
So yeah. So great. All right, I'm done with that bit that I had planned, so now we can go on to now we can go on to other things. Man, that wasn't even funny.
Actually, it was. I was just stifling my I was playing along with you.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, to maintain what we've been doing in the past, we're going to do a quick rundown of what the box office looked like last weekend. Number one, again, Disturbia. Unbelievable.
Man.
Shia LaBeouf is still on top.
Shia LaBeouf.
Hey, and you know what? Maybe this is just, you know, it's the appetizer, as it will, for the meal that Transformers is going to be for him.
Is he in that too? You told me that.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That guy. He's crazy. Well, I'll tell you what. If he can play a robot that turns into a vehicle, I'm going to be pretty excited about his future career as an actor. I mean, I don't even think De Niro could play a robot that turns into a vehicle.
I don't know. I think De Niro might be able to pull that one off.
He might be able to. I mean,
it is Bob De Niro. I mean, come on.
It is. He could just look in the camera and be like, am I a car? Am I a car? And then everyone will be like, yeah, yeah, you are. You are a car. Don't kill me.
Let's see. Number two and three were a couple of new ones. The Invisible and Next, which, like we said earlier, Darren's got a review of Next up there.
And he kind of slammed it.
What's that?
He kind of slammed it.
He kind of slammed it, but, you know, that's what happens sometimes.
I know. I'm just trying to get some controversy out there. Good. It's number three, but he slammed it, so.
Hey, you know
what?
It's number three. He slammed it, and I believe this is the first of the text reviews is really a slam.
Right. All the other ones have been pretty much...
They've been pretty fairly positive.
Yeah. Well, you know, now that the studios have been reading our reviews for weeks, now we can really tell what we think of them, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, it's a good thing we gave Darren the go-ahead to, you know, trash a few
tear
movies. And yeah, that's right.
Yep. Fracture is came in at fourth, and Blades of Glory is in the top five.
Yeah!
Still at number five. Unbelievable. Let's see. Hot Fuzz, number six.
I think that movie's going to continue to... What was it last week? Number eight?
It was number six.
Oh,
it
was
number
it?
Six last week, and it's six? Number six again this week.
I wouldn't be surprised if it climbs up. It'll be the first movie maybe to climb up on the list that we've been reading off each week.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that one is... it's maintaining, and... it had just a smaller drop off from the week before, and it actually increased the number of theaters that it was in by like 50%.
And it maintained its position.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. Where Meet the Robinsons and Vacancy both were above Hot Fuzz, now they are below Hot Fuzz.
Well, they opened a lot earlier, though. Meet the Robinsons did. I don't know what Vacancy is. I can't remember.
Vacancy opened last week also.
That was the Halle Berry one?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And that one had a drop-off. I guess that one's just going quick.
Halle Berry's career seems to be in the tank, so I have some career advice for Halle Berry. I think that if you do a movie with Will Ferrell, you're going to be okay. I think it would really be great to see a Will Ferrell movie with Halle Berry in it.
And, you know, the movies that she was topless in, she did fairly well also.
Yeah, I think those made a fair amount of money.
I think, you know, if she was topless in a Will Ferrell movie.
I think that would work. I mean, he's topless in every one of his movies.
Yes, he
is.
So
why not have Halle Berry, when she's in it, also be topless?
I think that would get some people into the box office.
Now, that's some decent logic right there.
They should listen to us. They should let us, you know, cast these movies and make them ourselves.
Let's send this to Damon and Affleck. We've got it. You got the new
script.
Exactly.
Let's see. Number nine, The Condemned. That was another new one.
What's that about?
You know, I'm not real sure.
Yeah, who cares? All right, number 10.
You know, the movie guys not knowing what movies are coming out. Number 10, Are We Done Yet? Cube.
Yes.
Cube is still
stay alive.
Into the top 10.
It's like
he's
Survivor.
Fading fast, but he's still in. He's still in the top 10. So there you have it. That was the box office for this past weekend. And we're going to forego any kind of reviews this time so that we can dig right into the movies that we like.
That's right.
So did you want to go first? You want me to go first? Does it matter?
Why don't you go first?
All right. The movie that you know, if somebody asks me flat out, what's your favorite movie, it takes me all of about a half a second to, you know, pause and reflect and say, well, of course, it's North by Northwest. The Alfred Hitchcock classic. It's a fun movie. It's a thriller. It's got a romance to it. It's got some really great twists and turns. It's a road picture. One of the taglines for the movie was a 3,000-mile chase. And it had, you know, it got some Oscar nods. And it just an all around, it's a fun movie. And it keeps up the thrills and the fun. And even the premise of it's very lighthearted in how it all sets up. I mean, it's got some weight to it being the undertow of the Cold War and everything, you know, the undercurrent of having the Cold War being a big part of it. But the basic premise is you've got Roger Thornhill, played by Cary Grant, and he's just being full on Cary Grant. He's a playboy. He's an ad exec who's out with, I can't remember if he's out with friends or clients, and he's at
clients,
a hotel bar.
I
believe it is. He's at a hotel bar, and he has to make a phone call to his mother because he was supposed to be meeting with her. And he raises his hand for the waiter to come over and bring him a phone. At the same moment that he raises his hand for the waiter to bring him a phone, two gentlemen are at the front of the bar, and they're paging someone. And I'm blanking now on the name. And it's there's this spy that they're looking for. And it's the same moment that Thornhill raises his hand. They're paging this other guy, and these spies mistake Thornhill for this spy. And it's someone that they need to stop. You know, it's if you haven't seen the movie, if you're going to be very surprised by it, I'll go ahead and say that we'll go ahead and spoil the movie. The gist of it is the spy doesn't exist. It's a ruse. It's a fake identity the government has concocted to throw off these spies, and they check this fake identity into hotels wherever major events go down. So basically, they're creating a paper trail for someone who doesn't exist.
Right.
And these spies think that Thornhill is this other spy.
Right.
And they capture him. You know, there's a lot of misinformation and misidentity going on where you're not sure who each person is you're meeting at first, if they're legitimate, if they're a spy. The government gets involved and basically tells Thornhill he has to continue playing this role to keep the spies off track, you know, to let them continue believing that he is who they think he is and not who he really is.
And it all sounds really serious, but I mean, obviously Cary Grant's funny, but it really is almost hyperbole how far over the top he accidentally throws himself into that man's life, that man who doesn't exist.
Oh my goodness.
The scene in the UN is the best scene.
Oh yeah.
Because it looks as if I'm going to give it away. It looks as if he stabbed the woman, and then he's catching her and he's pulling the knife from her, and it looks almost exactly as if he stabbed her, and then that's the exact press photo taken, and it's just so bizarre. It's just so funny.
Oh yeah.
And he's just good at doing what he does. You know, being the suave, bumbling. I don't know if there is a modern equivalent for Cary Grant's type of humor.
I mean, I don't know. It's so over the top and so cool, and I mean, he's just a cool guy.
Yeah.
You know? There's really not there's really not a whole lot more to it than that. And there's all kinds of cool trivia surrounding the movie. If you check the movie out, which I highly recommend, renting the movie, or even buying it, you can probably even pick up a non collector's edition version fairly inexpensively. I mean, the movie is 50 years old now, but, the edition I have of it has a a commentary track by the writer, and it was just really interesting to see what his take on it was, his experiences with Hitchcock and with the studio. There's a really great scene, and this will be about the only one that I'll really go into too much depth on, just because one, I don't want to bore too many people, but another one is just, this one is really easy to spot if you're looking for it, and it's amazing that it got as far as it did. There's a scene with Roger Thornhill and Eve Kendall, and Eve is played by Eva Marie Saint. She is the you're not sure if she's a counter spy, who she's exactly working for, but she ends up becoming kind of a love interest for them. There's a really good bit of back and forth, and these two have just amazing chemistry. There's a scene where she says to him something like, "I tipped the steward to seat you here next to me," and they're on a train, and this is part of the chase. They end up on a train, and they're in, I believe, a dining car. And he says, "You know, are you propositioning me?" And she says, "I never discuss love on an empty stomach."
Hmm.
And he says, "You've already eaten." And she says, "But you haven't." I mean, it's just this really great, and the dialogue is delivered just beautifully, and the writing is really great. The cool thing about
Hitchcock
that scene
himself, was he a co-writer, or did he just direct the?
No, he just directed it. He kind of commissioned the writing of it because he had some ideas of what he wanted, and he hired this guy based on some conversations they had, and the writer gives the full story as part of the content I have, but the point of what I'm describing here is, if you watch the movie. And you watch Eva Marie Saint's lips while she's delivering the line, "I never discuss love on an empty stomach." The words that she's speaking is not discuss.
Hmm.
She says make.
"I never make love on an empty stomach."
Now, this is 1959.
Right.
And, I mean, that was extremely...
They probably were like, "Change that."
Yeah, extremely risque. For the time, especially to have Cary Grant, you know, in a movie where they'd be talking like that, because it was just so over the top. The innuendo is pretty strong, even for "I never discuss love on an empty stomach."
Right.
They didn't think it was they were going to be able to keep even that line in the movie, and they were amazed that they got away with just doing an audio dub of her.
I remember thinking, as I was watching the movie, that even the impropriety of their affair, I thought, for 1959 was over the top. Like,
she was kind. I mean, she was pretty forward. Even, I mean, by modern terms, she was very forward. But in terms of this, she was a slut.
she was an agent, so she was
exactly.
Doing a job.
Well, yeah, she was doing her job, and she was using sex, you know, to further her cause, but yeah, she was a tramp. It was, I mean, if you really think about the period when the movie was shot in and released, I mean, that was very different than what you would normally see. So, yeah, that's kind of
the interesting thing about that movie is I don't know if I can place its time in terms of, like, you know, where spy movies were then. I kind of know more, like, from the 70s on. But
sure.
I thought it was interesting that they picked all the craziest locations for all of the action to take place. Like,
absolutely.
I didn't know if that itself was tongue-in-cheek or if that was just to... like, up the spy ante, like, to make it a big spy movie, or if that itself was just making fun of other spy movies. Like, at the end, when they're climbing up and down Mount Rushmore, it's just so...
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, I mean, so what do you think it was? Do you think it was just, you know, taking the whole genre lightly, or do you think it was literally supposed to be dramatic?
I think it was literally supposed to be dramatic. I don't think that... I think they were just basically turning everything up. You know,
right.
Just completely imping up the adventure, the thrills, the suspense. I mean, if you look at the movie, you can see where... I mean, there are some iconic scenes within the movie. The fight that takes place on Mount Rushmore, Cary Grant being chased through the fields by the plane. These are things that, you know, whenever you see greatest clips or biggest thrills of, you know, the 100 biggest thrills movies, things like that, that AFI occasionally does. Those scenes and those images are the kinds of things that you see in there.
Yeah.
I think, and I mean, I'm not really up on the spy genre of film, as it were, but it really feels like North by Northwest was kind of cutting the way, you know, making room for things like James Bond.
Yeah, because Dr. No was 3 or 4 years later.
Yeah, just the over-the-top, you know...
Yeah, really, it's ahead of all of those movies.
Exactly.
I mean, the ones you're right. I mean, the first Bond movie was in... I didn't even really think about that. First Bond movie was in 62, so it kind of sets the stage.
Exactly.
You're totally right. I didn't even think about that.
And then if you look at the action in the movie, it's so over-the-top, and... I mean, you know, I mean, they're chasing a guy with an airplane.
Right.
You know? I mean, that's something totally out of a James Bond movie. It's, you know, I think it led the way and kind of set the standard for the way action and suspense and adventure all should kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I mean, it seemed now like it was poking fun at those movies, but those movies hadn't even been made yet.
Exactly.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
And you know, I think the story still holds up. It's just a lot of fun.
It's great interest. I mean, you don't really know what's going on until 2/3 of the movie are over. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah. And I mean, the great thing is Cary Grant is just so suave and so cool that you're just. And you know he's not that guy. I mean, you just know he's this
right. This
bumbling ad exec. You know, he's kind of a tool. He's not this. He's not a spy. But I think the only other thing that I'm going to say before we move on is the character of his mother, Clara Thornhill, is just. She's just great.
She is great.
She plays his foil. You know, she is this loud, boisterous, over the top character that you can totally see how the relationship works from the first time that they interact together. It's
loving, but it's very sarcastic and really...
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like
brutally sarcastic.
Yeah. Like, he's like, I'm really a spy. Or he didn't say that. He said, no, someone's after me. And her responses are just classic.
Oh, yeah. She I mean, for how well the movie's written, some of the best stuff takes place between Roger and his mother.
And that's in the first 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Film. I mean... And I think their interplay is what makes you keep on watching because you get really involved with that character. You really get involved and you kind of feel for Roger that, you know, yeah, he's kind of bumbling, but his mom's kind of over the top. And
right. And,
you know, he's Cary Grant, but he's at the same time, I mean, he is just kind of a guy, you know, he's made mistakes and he's, you know, his mom browbeats him and, you know, he kind of fumbles through life. And, so you do feel for the guy at the same time.
I guess almost the equivalent of this in modern day is like the Big Lebowski, except the Big Lebowski the guy really is pretty dumb.
Yeah, he
is. I mean,
is.
He's really dumb, and there's actually no plot. Whereas right. in this, there is a plot.
Yep.
So it's kind of like that, except with a lot more structure, probably better storytelling.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, let's go ahead and take a quick break, and we'll come right back, and we will discuss your film.
Okay.
May 25th, 1977. A strange little movie took the world by storm and became a phenomenon. Now, in May of 2007, Things Are Looking Up is proud to present the Star Wars 30th Anniversary Extravaganza, a whole month of podcast episodes devoted to celebrating the 30th anniversary of Star Wars, featuring interviews with three of the brightest and most outspoken individuals in the Star Wars modern fan movement today. Nathan P. Butler, host of Chrono Radio and webmaster of StarWarsFanWorks.com.
We now find he was a character who felt like he was justified in his actions. He always felt as if what he was doing was for a greater good.
Lou Tambone, webmaster of T-Bone Star Wars Universe and GalacticSenate.com.
It's not my film, Judge, to say this is wrong and this is right. He should have did this and he should have did that. I mean, those are maybe some of my opinions. How can I say it's wrong?
And Chris Mott, director and producer of The Force Among Us and official guest of Star Wars Celebration 4.
I hope that people see this movie as fans and say that we painted a really positive picture about them. If you don't see yourself in this movie, you're going to see somebody that you know.
Plus, all the best of my commentary on the saga from past episodes, as well as new content. This is the podcasting event 30 years in the making.
Disclaimer. Since podcasting has been around for less than a decade, this event could be reasonably considered as only a couple months in the making, as the host is prone to having
delusions of grandeur.
Point your browser to podcast.indianajim.net and join the celebration this May.
All right, we are back, and I guess I'm going to tell you about Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid.
Sure, why not?
Okay. Sounds great. Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is... It's not my favorite movie of all time, but it is one of my favorites. It's my favorite, one of my favorites for a lot of reasons. One, it's a great Western.
Mm-hmm.
Made in the 70s, you know, at a time when Westerns really kind of reached their apex, in my opinion.
Right.
And the... film was a very troubled film. It was made by Peckinpah. It was intended to be his masterpiece, but it ended up being chopped up by the studio and not given enough time to work. Actually, to say that it was chopped up by the studio isn't entirely accurate. Peckinpah did oversee the cut that went to the theaters, but he wasn't satisfied with it. They had put a lot of pressure on him to get the film out because they wanted to show a lot of cash on hand. So they were trying to release as many films as quickly as they could to build sure. the MGM Grand in Las Vegas.
And
so
okay.
the film hobbled into theaters not quite finished. And Peckinpah wasn't happy with it, and he always was confrontational anyway. And so he had a lot of trouble from the beginning with studio executives and that sort of thing. And had kind of a me versus them attitude. So he didn't get very far with them. And the movie was very uneven and left the theater shortly and was widely hailed as a disaster. In 1988, they found some more footage and put together an alternate cut of the film. But it was missing some parts of the 1973 film that were very important to character development.
Okay.
And the 1988 film, while showing some of the parts that had never been seen before and being released on Turner Television, was really more of a novelty than the definitive version of the film because all it was an alternate cut of the film.
Right.
It wasn't really the vision of the film. So the 2005 version came out, and it really puts everything together. It gives you the best of both films. It really does what Peckinpah, I believe, intended to do, which was make the film about Pat Garrett. who was, you know, really trying to define himself as a person who was going to civilize along with the rest of the West.
Right.
And Billy the Kid, his antagonist, their previously really great friends, remains the kind of idealistic Wild West figure. And Pat Garrett, even though he civilizes himself, he's really not happy in that world. He comes to hate everything about himself. There's a very telling scene that I think is great. It's not in the 1988 version, which is one of the reasons that version's so weak. It's where he's with his wife, and you see how miserable his wife is, how obsessed he is with getting the kid, how little he cares about her and his family life, because up until the week before, he had never been a lawman, and he wasn't a family man. He was playing a role that he wasn't good at. And later in the movie, you see him with a bunch of prostitutes, and that's where he's happy. That's where he has no emotional connection. You know, he is Billy the Kid.
Yeah, but, and, I mean, in that scene, he's even, I mean, he's almost giddy.
Yeah.
The scene with the prostitutes, he's almost giggling. He's just so, I mean, it's just obviously very freeing to him.
Right,
to be
I mean
a bad boy in that way, you know.
And yet, even the style of that scene, it's so detached, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like it's part of a different movie.
Right.
It really does.
It's a lot different than the scene where Billy the Kid is with his woman at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, that is so, it's such a slow and tender scene. And, you know, it's right before Pat Garrett kills him. And just Billy the Kid's appreciation for her is on a different level than Garrett, who seemed to be, and this is just my personal take on the film, seems to consume everything in his path, you know, in his quest to get the kid, which isn't really even who he wants to be. And it's just a film, I mean, obviously, you know, the West had to civilize, and the idealistic portrayal of the kid as some kind of Christ-like, you know, messianic figure of the West is neat, I think. Not at all accurate, you know.
Right,
It's just a Western fantasy that...
Well, one of the things I was going to say, you know, I was kind of thinking about putting some of the ideas behind me into context of the time. Excuse me, I'm just getting over a cold. That's why we're recording this a bit late. This one was shot in the very beginning of the 70s, and there was still very much the, you know, the idea of, you know,
free love,
free love, down with corporations,
right?
You know, if you grow up, then you're out of it, man, and all that. There did seem to be some of the feel of that in how they portrayed Billy versus how they portrayed Pat, and I mean, it was almost like very weird comparison. Clerks 2, where the guys realize they're growing up,
right?
And do they choose to grow up and conform with what's going on around them, or do they maintain the attitudes of youth, and what is that going to do to them? And I thought it was interesting that he chose this story to forward some of those themes, because eventually, what happens is Billy ends up dying for his youth and his freedom.
Right. And it's a very kind of peaceful. It's peaceful for him, not for Garrett. He looks at Garrett and he smiles.
Yeah.
And Garrett pulls the trigger. And Garrett blows the mirror away and looks at himself in the fractured mirror. Sees the pieces of himself which, you know, highly symbolic. There's a lot of over-symbolism in the film. I wouldn't say it's a great film. It's just a film I really, really like because
sure.
I like the... it's like the same thing. It's the over-top nature of the Western. It's just pushing it so far out into a region where it's just about, you know, where Kris Kristofferson says, you know, the law's a funny thing, ain't it? He says, last week you and I were riding with Chisholm, and now you're a sheriff, and I'm
right.
on the other side of the law. Last week we were the law. And I just thought, it's just an interesting meditation on that. I also like, I mean, I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan.
Yeah.
And Bob Dylan's in it, and he's a horrible actor, but he's in it. And
he just kind of stands there looking like Bob Dylan.
Oh, my God. It's bad.
But every scene where he's just standing there looking like Bob Dylan, he's fine. It's right? when he starts talking that things start breaking down pretty quick.
I know. It's pretty rough. But the score was all done by him, and the music is amazing.
Yeah, it was really nice. At one point, I caught the riff of Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Right.
That was really nice to hear in there.
That was written for the film.
And it's absolutely perfectly appropriate for the film, too.
Right.
You know, the song is a great tune. And, I mean, my biggest experience with the song is when Guns N' Roses remade the song. But the lyrics, I mean, if you listen to the lyrics, it's completely about Pat Garrett.
Yeah.
It's his story.
Exactly.
So, yeah. This was a flawed film. And one that, you know, I saw it, and I see, knowing your taste, I can see why you enjoyed the film. If somebody's going to ask me if, you know, if I would recommend it to them, I probably, you know, unless I know them well enough to know taste like yours, I wouldn't recommend it to a lot of people. I think if you're in the flavor for hearing the story told in an even more over the top and it for at least for me more entertaining way, I would have to point to Young Guns 2, which is basically the same story.
I haven't seen that, but you kept talking about it after you'd seen the movie. You're like, even James Coburn reprises his role in that story, or not as Pat Garrett, but he's in the story again as Chisholm.
He is in the story again, and this time he plays Chisholm, which I think is kind of funny that, you know, as a younger man, he played Garrett, and as an older man, he plays Chisholm, which Chisholm is the one who basically hires Pat Garrett it's this weird relationship that from seeing both movies and then doing a little bit of reading about it, I don't quite get how, and I think this may be where Hollywood has taken a little bit of artistic license with the characters of Chisholm and Pat Garrett, because it seems like Pat Garrett is hired by Chisholm to become the sheriff that will chase down Billy the Kid. Which, if you start thinking about it, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But considering that, you know, landowners were politicians and had weight in the community, it very well could have been accurate. But it's... For the sake of the films, it's very much glossed over, and kind of pushed aside.
I mean, the politics is referenced to in the film we're talking about,
right?
But it's not important. It more frames the center of the story, which is Pat Garrett's journey from one side of the law to another, and having to
right.
live with himself for betraying his identity,
right?
And his
and
soul.
I think the difference, one of the many differences is, and you said yourself that they portrayed in Paul's film, they portrayed Billy the Kid as a Christ-like figure. He's this freeing, open soul. And Pat Garrett is Judas.
Right.
I mean, he is taking money to go after, you know, his friend and the person he rode alongside.
And I mean, it's a classic story. It's not. I mean, there's nothing particularly about the film that is groundbreaking anyway.
No.
But the story told in a Western fashion, at a time in the 70s when Westerns were really stylized and very far out. This is about, I think, the farthest out and the bleakest of anything I've ever seen, and for all of its flaws, I like it. It has a lot of cultural touches that I like. I like the Dylan music. I like Kris Kristofferson. Sure. I think if you listen to one of Kris Kristofferson's albums, he was an outlaw country musician, and right. It just makes perfect sense if you know Kristofferson the musician that he's playing the kid, because
except that he's too old to be playing the kid.
Well, yeah, I mean he's a little older than a kid. But
yeah, I mean, he's quite a bit older than the kid too. I mean,
right.
And he doesn't, I mean, they cleaned him up real good, and he's not wearing his, you know, his old man facial hair that, you know, most people, when they think of Kris Kristofferson, that's, you know, the image they have of him.
Right.
He's not like that. So he looks much younger than most times when you see him, but he's not as young as Billy the Kid should have been.
Yeah, he's still pretty craggy looking.
Yeah.
And his voice is really, really deep because he's Kris Kristofferson.
Right.
But it works for me as a person. Well, it works in the context of the fantasy that Billy the Kid is this Robin Hood character. Right. And Kris Kristofferson and the outlaw country music, that's what that was all about. It was about, you know, just cutting loose and living for now and being free, and you know, you had to do time in prison to really be free, and it was, you know, it's very interesting to look at it now, you know, and to project back then and kind of look at, definitely a product of its time, and I just I really enjoy it. So
well, very cool. You know, in watching this film, that, you know, it struck me pretty early on that there were some similarities between this one and Young Guns 2. And one of the things that I kind of was just sitting here thinking about, an interesting thing with having Dylan doing the music and being and appearing in the film is that John Bon Jovi did the music for Young Guns 2 and appeared in the film.
You know, I mean,
Now, granted, his appearance was, if you blink, you miss it. And he really didn't score the movie at all. I'm making light of it.
Oh, I know. Bob, I haven't seen Young Guns 2, but
Bob Dylan's scoring of Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is incredible. It's very, very well done. And it's what's great about it is you can tell that it's a product of the time, it's a product of Dylan, and it's a product of the story that's being told.
Right.
And it's music that you would not have heard in a 50s Western. It's music you would not have heard in an 80s, you know, in a movie from the 80s or even now.
Right.
It's very much it captured the time that the film was made. But it had flourishes of what, you know, what could translate into music from a Western.
Right. It really seems to be another product of that fantasy West.
Right.
You know, it's such a great I just love, I can retreat to one of those spaghetti westerns from the 60s or 70s. And this isn't a spaghetti western, but
no.
I can retreat into those era westerns. And it's just an alternate fantasy of America that didn't exist before it, didn't exist after that period of filmmaking, never really existed, but it's definitely a place that exists somewhere in those directors' minds and those musicians and actors, because it's all about the gunfight and the final showdown, or
right.
or riding from town to town, and who you meet along the way, and
absolutely,
and the music is very distinct and full of abstractions. It's just different. It's almost like medieval knights' tales, except it's just set in the Old West.
Right, right. You know, one thing kind of interesting about the films that both of us chose is that they were both directed by guys who are very dynamic individuals.
Right. And yeah, I mean,
Hitchcock and Peckinpah are characters, you know, outside of being great directors, they both have a following in the types of films that they direct, and they're both characters off screen as well. I mean, some of the stuff that, and I mean, I didn't have a lot of experience with Peckinpah as an individual, but apparently he was fond of urinating on things that he didn't like.
Yeah, there is actually something Christofferson refers to in an interview on the DVD where he says Bob Dylan comes to the set the first day and Sam Peckinpah had a cut, didn't like it. They were watching it in one of these tiny movie prompters or whatever, and right. he just unzips his fly and he urinates just all over the screen. And he says he was furious, and Dylan looks over at Christofferson like, what the hell did you just get me into? It's apparently how the story goes. Peckinpah was an interesting character.
Yeah.
He, I believe, and I don't want to say anything that's not true, but I believe he was pretty constantly drunk at any given point during any shooting.
Right.
He was a womanizer, like Hitchcock was.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely
had Hitchcock had some serious problems with if you look at his films, at least as any example, he had some problems with women.
With women?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's...
He had some very bizarre notions of how women should be treated and things like that. And if you watch enough of his films, it becomes evident that things aren't always, you know, right.
Right.
They're kind of like Tim Burton and his obvious thing that he has about his dad.
Right.
There's a father son dynamic that is always very bizarre and strange and strained in his films.
I mean, they're very alike in a lot of ways. I mean, to right. say that their character was much the same, I wouldn't know if that's really the right thing to say, but troubled people, they definitely were.
Right.
And their films are evident of that. I mean,
yes. And I wouldn't say that their characters are the same. I would say that they were both dynamic characters as people.
Right. Right.
They were apparently people who would be interesting to be around. And not always in the most positive ways.
But Hitchcock really, I mean, Hitchcock is on the short list of one of the greatest of all time.
Absolutely.
Peckinpah is a good director.
Right.
But I don't believe he's a great director. He's not the best Western director, even.
Right.
He's very good. I think Sergio Leone is much better. I mostly gravitate towards this film because of its musical elements and its really just far out 70s vision of what the West might have been like.
Yeah.
It's just over the top. And I don't know if that's what Peckinpah wanted, but that's what he produced. And there's nothing like it. I haven't ever seen anything like it. I know that The Wild Bunch is widely touted as his greatest movie, but I've just never seen anything like this film.
Cool.
But anyway, you know, Peckinpah, right. He died early, I think. He didn't get to finish. He didn't direct a lot of great movies like Hitchcock did, and that's a shame. I mean, yeah. Who knows what he could have been capable of, but...
Exactly.
But I guess it's a good time to call it quits on this one.
Sure.
And I'll look forward to seeing Lucky You with you.
Exactly.
Next
yeah,
week
we are,
and commenting on it.
We are taking the ladies out this weekend and we're gonna check out Lucky You this weekend.
Yep.
The alternate
Karen just said Lucky Me before.
the alternate programming to what you know everybody and their brother is going to be seeing this weekend,
right?
That being Spider-Man 3, and you know if we get the opportunity to see it this weekend, we will probably discuss it. And I bet good money that by the time you're listening to. Next week's episode, we have at least one text review of Spider-Man 3 up.
Absolutely.
And if not, you know, blame Josh and Darren. Those are the guys that do that.
But I don't think they'll let us down.
I don't think so. I think they will. They'll be checking it out.
Even if we told them don't go see Spider-Man 3, we'd probably right. see a review about it posted the next day anyway.
Probably. So. Yeah. I mean that's the one thing that that we and you'll see this if you read those reviews you can tell it's pretty obvious. The one thing that we asked of both of the reviewers is to not be afraid to have different opinions than us. Darren has his opinion, Josh has his opinion, I have mine, you have yours. You know, we're four different guys at four different stages in our lives, and it makes for differing opinions.
Yep.
And as far as I'm concerned, that's great because
lucky
you'll
us.
Be able to you'll be able to know as a listener, as a reader, you'll know whose opinion gravitates more towards your tastes. For a particular type of movie, genre, what have you. And, listen to us. And hopefully we can steer you in the right directions for what you may enjoy seeing.
There you go. Absolutely.
And so Lucky You is going to be our next one next week. And, it's been a great year. We've had a lot of changes. We joined Farpoint Media, which has been a great change. Have made a ton of new friends through that, and
I love you, Farpoint.
Yeah, we're part of a big family now. It's cool, and I really don't have anything else to say other than I look forward to keep doing this for a lot more years.
All right.
All right.
Well, I'll see you next week.
let's just make it through next week.
All right, dude. You take it easy. Right.
Have a good one. See ya.
Bye.
As always, you can leave us a voicemail at 206-339-FBSD. That's 206-339-3273. You can send us an email at fanboysmackdown@gmail.com. You can leave a message on the website in our comments section, fanboysmackdown.com, or visit us at the Farpoint Media Forums, farpforums.com. Thanks. She was a slut.